I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
Glitchcore, or Hyperpop, or Robloxcore? Anyway, you get the idea.
So first off, I'm going to start off by saying, what is Hyperpop?
Now, if you haven't heard of Hyperpop, then you're probably severely out of the loop, at least in terms of the upcoming SoundCloud scene.
This genre of music has been taking TikTok by storm.
The last few years have seen the rise of a vibrant and strange genre of music called hyperpop.
You put all that together, and to me, what you have is a genre that feels like a home for the outsiders and misfits and people who probably feel like they don't really fit in anywhere.
Inspired by major label pop music, its growth has been spurred on via the internet, through SoundCloud, Twitter, and now Spotify.
And I'm somebody that absolutely loves the genre. I just figured I would make this video to sort of explain what I know about it and what makes me really love hyperpop and why I think it's the future of music.
The term hyperpop has been linked with some of the most exciting young artists from around the world. So where exactly did this genre come from? And what can its ascent tell us about the influence of big corporations like Spotify?
Charlie XCX just tweeted, "What is hyperpop?" So it's on a lot of people's minds right now.
Today, behind the rise of hyperpop. It's Thursday, the 10th of June. So today we are talking about a genre called hyperpop. Where do you want to start this story?
I think no matter where we start, it would probably be very kind of controversial and debated within the scene itself.
Shard D'Souza is a freelance music writer for The Guardian.
So I think a good place to start is with a duo called 100 Gex.
Boop, boop, boop. Right here live on Twitch, we are doing an exclusive interview with the most beloved but also polarizing music duos on the internet right now, 100 Gex, Miss Laura Less. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good.
Tell me about them. Who are 100 Gex?
100 Gex are a duo from the US consisting of Dylan Brady and Laura Less, who are two kind of like figures who have been around underground electronic music for a little while now, kind of in slightly different spheres.
Hey, you little piss baby, you think you're so fucking cool, huh? You think you're so fucking tough? You talk a lot of big game for someone with such a small truck.
They've got a bunch of kind of pretty viral-ish tracks, the most popular probably being Money Machine.
And then you'd love it, you text me I love you, and then I'd fucking ghost you.
They were becoming really, really popular off the back of kind of SoundCloud, but also this really strong Twitter community, and also just the fact that their music was very meme-y, like it really mimicked the language of the internet.
How so? What do you mean by that?
It's a lot of non sequiturs, it's a lot of intentional malapropism, it's a lot of evoking memes, like textual memes.
Can you think of a line that kind of like embodies that at all?
Well, I mean, it would be every line, you know?
Hey, you little piss baby. You think you're so fucking cool? Huh? You think you're so fucking tough?
It just recreates, I guess, aesthetically and sonically, the kind of like real-time updating, the real-time recreation of the internet.
I thought that piss baby was like a phrase that people said online. I don't know, like shitlord or something, just a innocuous insult, I guess, which I guess was not the case.
Illogical if you don't understand certain kinds of internet languages.
You talk a lot of big game for someone with such a small truck. Oh, look at those arms. Your arms look so fucking cute. They look like little cigarettes. I bet I could smoke you. I could roast you.
This person thinks that he's got a big truck and he thinks he's sick as fuck and he thinks he's got big meaty arms. None of those things are true. They're all a falsehood.
And so it struck a chord with so many people because it, like more than pretty much any other music, it feels reflective of a certain, I guess, chaotic element to our day-to-day lives that's hard to convey in any kind of art.
Feels so clean like a money machine.
Feel so clean like a money machine. Feel so clean like a money machine.
So 100 Gex released their debut album 1000 Gex, and they were becoming quite popular, not quite like virality, but a lot of people were kind of taking notice and getting really excited about this duo.
Mm.
And, you know, I think people at Spotify probably kind of started to notice that there was this little thing emerging outside of their usual algorithms or what have you, that was getting really big and that was probably going to portend some kind of larger boom in this kind of sound.
Mm, so Spotify takes notice. What do they do?
Basically, there's people at Spotify whose job it is to identify any kind of trends and basically get ahead of them.
Mm.
They kind of had a sift around the metadata around this music, which is such a strange way to think about music. But anyway, they had a look around the metadata and found this tag in a lot of the music that was kind of associated with 100 Gex, and that tag was hyperpop. And so they were like, okay, obviously something's bubbling here. Let's, you know, put a stamp on it. So they kind of made a playlist using that name with a lot of these artists that were associated with 100 Gex. And then it's, in a sense, it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because if Spotify chooses to elevate something, you know, that's millions of listeners who are going to hear it and going to be like, oh, this is hyperpop.
Mm, so Spotify basically used an algorithm to put together a playlist and stamped it with this term hyperpop. Could you call this the beginning of a new genre, or is that not really accurate?
Like, although this was the first time hyperpop had been kind of catalogued as hyperpop, the sound itself kind of did have roots in this British collective called PC Music.
Mm, tell me about this music collective, PC Music.
So PC Music was this very hypey, very talked about collective that emerged in the early 2010s, probably around 2012 or 2013, led by this producer, A.G. Cook.
Mm.
And they kind of gained notoriety because they were making pop music, essentially, that didn't sound like any pop music, or it didn't sound like any music at all. I guess like a classic example of this kind of early PC Music sound would be this song Beautiful by A.G. Cook. It was this sound that was like super, it was much easier to talk about it textually than sonically. You know, it sounded rubbery, it sounded metallic, it sounded non-porous, it sounded very abrasive. Hallmarks of the sound were like synths that sounded like metal being ripped apart. And then atop that, you had these really high-pitched, quote-unquote, feminine vocals often. The early beginnings of what came to its final form in 100 Gex.
So it's kind of like something if you imagine you went to an experimental art night. There might be sounds similar in this genre, this early formation of it.
You know, maybe, but the funny thing is I think it struck a chord because it actually felt a lot more like, say you were going to like an Aqua show, but you were like on PCP or something, you know, like, because it was kind of like, it was reminiscent of this like 90s, 2000s, like Eurotrance sound, but just like pushed up to the outer limits of what could be considered pop music.
Mm.
It was immediately very controversial. Like sites like Pitchfork and Stereogum and stuff started covering the collective, and it was not exactly anonymous, but people had no idea really who these people were.
Mm.
There was so many kind of like academic articles and think pieces about it. And a lot of people really hated it and were kind of confused about what was going on. But, you know, that was definitely the start and the kind of seed of what has now become this underground behemoth that is hyperpop.
Mm, and who are the artists who are in this collective and sounds like maybe defined this scene?
The two key figures, I would say, are A.G. Cook and Sophie. So A.G. obviously founded PC Music, but he was friends with this producer, this Scottish producer named Sophie. And Sophie really is slash was, Sophie passed away earlier this year, but is a kind of giant of the scene. And Sophie had this pretty incredible production philosophy. Sophie basically wanted to push the discourse around electronic music. You know, we think of things like, oh, there's a kick and there's like a hi-hat and there's like keys or whatever. Mm. And Sophie was kind of like, that's all so deeply rooted in metaphor. Like, why do we need to codify limitless sounds in that sense? You know, pretend it's like the same method as how people were doing it in the 70s or whatever, you know, live in a studio. And so Sophie was like, if we remove ourselves from those kind of metaphorical structures of how to make music, things can be kind of like limitless in terms of the sounds we create. This really early single, Bip, yeah, sounds like a rubber ball being bounced around. And then this song from Sophie's debut album, Immaterial, really kind of makes that ideology tangible in this quite radical, like, political way. It was this incredible, totally groundbreaking sound based in this philosophy that now I believe a lot of people have been very, very inspired by.
So Sophie, A.G. Cook, are there any other big names from this genre that we should know about?
Well, yeah.
Next guest is a pop superstar. Charlie XCX has been nominated for Grammys, for Brits, MTV Awards, as well as winning two...
Another key figure who didn't kind of like originate the genre or start in the genre, but who has become emblematic of the form would be Charlie XCX.
Charlie XCX is behind some of Billboard's hottest hits. So why does he still consider himself the anti-pop star?
Who is this British pop star? She was a writer to begin with. She started making pop music when she was like 13 or 14. So Charlie had a number one on songs that she kind of co-wrote and featured on. So one was I Love It by Iconopop. And one was Fancy by Iggy Azalea. I'm so fancy, you already know. And then shortly after Fancy, she had a top 10 hit with Boom Clap, which was featured in the soundtrack for The Fault in Our Stars. This must be love. Boom, clap, sound in my heart. The beat goes on and on and on and on. Boom, clap, you make me feel good. Come on to me, come on to me now. And I think she felt very boxed in by this notion of success, because although she was kind of like on the up, it was a very kind of like strictured, very kind of bland sound compared to what she wanted to be making. And so around 2015, 2016, when PC Music was becoming like a little bigger, like a little more well-known, like Sophie was working with Madonna and stuff like that, Charlie was like, this is like the future of music and I want to be part of it. And so she worked with Sophie on this EP called Vroom Vroom, which is probably the defining document of hyperpop so far. Loving the Lamborghini, roll up in a blue bikini. Bitches on the beaches looking super cute and freaky. All my friends are princesses, we keep it whipped and creamy. Ice cubes on our tongues because we like to keep... In some people's eyes, I'm sure it would have been seen as kind of like a squandering of talent and potential success, because she was kind of like on the way to chart success but had decided to kind of work with these underground random producers instead.
Was it very popular?
For a lot of people, I think this EP was massive. And like, it's interesting. It's so hard to kind of reckon with how popular or unpopular this music is, because on one level, you're talking about it as if it's quote unquote pop music. And in the scale of pop music, it's completely unpopular. But then if you think about it as, you know, groundbreaking experimental musicians, it is like perhaps the most popular, genuinely experimental music has ever been.
Yeah.
And so thinking about it in terms of popularity is kind of a non-starter because it's so impossible to reckon with the way these worlds have kind of collided.
Mm.
And like, obviously you listen to Vroom Vroom, the song, and 5 years ago it sounded insane. I remember one of my friends being like to me, oh my God, this is so crazy. Like, this is so, like, no one will ever want to listen to this. And now 5 years later, so much pop music sounds like it.
Mm.
And now she's become a kind of a figurehead in lieu of any kind of actual sense of what the genre is.
So let's ride. Bitches know they can't catch me. Cute, sexy, and my ride sporty. Those sucks know they can't catch me. Beep, beep, so let's ride.
What about the scene in Australia? Is it very big here? Do we have many artists coming up?
I think it's definitely getting bigger here, but, you know, right from the start of, like, kind of PC music becoming a thing, there were definitely artists in Australia who were clearly very influenced by what was going on, what Sophie and AG were making, and were doing kind of like their own version of it down here. Early on, it was really embodied by these artists like Nina Jirachi and Donatachi and Oh Boy, like a lot of artists from Sydney and New South Wales, really. Yeah, you know, it was similar to PC music pop, but it was maybe a little brighter and maybe a little weirder, you know, maybe a little more, this is a really exaggerated, kind of silly, exciting version of pop that just feels really good.
Cool. Hi, I'm Donatachi and I'm a producer from Sydney, and I like to make music that is, I guess, hyper-pop.
We'll get into that.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
Next, Australian hyperpop and the fraught influence of Spotify. Okay, so how old were you when you first started getting into music yourself?
I guess I must have been in my early teens. I had a friend who was like really deeply into like rave music and techno, and I remember he loaned me this like demo CD of like some demo program. I can't remember what it was, but I started messing around with music, I guess, yeah, in my early teens, doing mashups mainly. Like I'd take the vocal from some pop song and put it over the top of like a techno beat. And
Can you give us an example?
There was this dub version of Better Off Alone, and I'd put, it was some Britney vocal, I really can't remember, but I've since like repurposed that. I ended up doing like a Better Off Alone mashup with Ariana Grande, which like I end up playing in all of my live sets now, and it always goes off.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, so from mashups, where did it go from there?
From then, I started like getting a little bit more involved in actually creating as opposed to just like slapping things on top of each other. Back then, I was like so inspired by like a lot of pop stars and I wanted to be one. And I think that's where this all stemmed from, is I wanted to be a pop star but couldn't sing and didn't really have like the X factor as far as like you can be a bad singer and still be a great pop star if you've got that, I guess, level of delusion where you can just like be super confident and that sells it. I never had that.
Tell me about your influences. Were you also inspired by the internet?
Definitely was inspired by the internet. I think though musically my biggest influences were mainstream major label top 40 pop. And I think that's something that myself and a lot of other hyper pop artists have in common, is like a lot of pop music is, I think, inspired by underground subgenres. Mm-hmm. And then they're filtered through to this point where they get to a mainstream sort of level of broad success. Whereas I think hyperpop is kind of the inverse, where a lot of us have been inspired by that big budget commercial pop top 40 stuff, but we've just like dialed it up to like 100, where it's like real, like essentially maximalism of those ideas. So it's almost, yeah, the reverse idea.
So when did you first hear of the term hyperpop?
I guess I'd kind of seen the term bouncing around a bit on SoundCloud. Mm. Like I had been listening to PC music, and so then I started, you know, working in a similar vein and putting my stuff out there. And then once I saw the hashtag, it just kind of made sense. And it was just like, oh, yeah, this is what fits. Like, because it was just a great descriptive word for what I was doing. And for me, it was just like, yeah, like I make hyperpop. I make like hyperpop in the most literal sense. It's like the most extreme, exaggerated version of pop music. So, yeah, it just kind of fit. Mm. This is something I can be part of. And it felt like a bit of a community.
When did you first get onto the Spotify playlist?
So the first song I had on the Spotify playlist was a song featuring Melbourne artist Evangeline called Do What I Want, which has kind of got this very playful, bouncy beat with bubbly sounds and just this whole lyrical energy of not giving a fuck about anyone and just focusing on yourself. And it's very queer central in that it's like lyrical content is very inclusive. The boys of the boys and girls of the
girls, they tell me to straighten up, I love my girl. Must be a bit of a thrill getting on that playlist for the very first time though, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. Although I have to say back then I didn't really see it as much of a an achievement. And maybe I was just like downplaying it at the time. But I think now that it is so much more established, I guess it is, yeah, a little bit more of a badge of honour.
So I've been speaking to Australian musician Donatachi. Have you heard of them and how would you describe their sound?
I would say Donatachi was like one of the first kind of producers kind of doing that hyperpop PC music sound in Australia and doing it in this really exciting, fun, bubbly, almost like silly, like I don't want to diminish their artistry, but like almost like silly kind of way. Mm. Them along with probably, yeah, like Nina Jirachi and a couple of other people were definitely the first wave of Australian hyperpop.
Can you describe what you've seen of how the community has grown in Australia?
I think it was definitely embodied in this club night in Sydney called Sidechains.
At that club night, a lot of the DJs would play a lot of PC music, a lot of Sophie and Charlie XCX and, yeah, a lot of other subgenres that were a little bit left afield. And I think a lot of us came together in that scene and met and then have since gone on to make music because we were inspired by the stuff we were hearing.
And there was a whole community around that kind of crew and their kind of FBI show and, yeah, you know, DJ sets and mixes and stuff that really pushed PC music here in a big way, and I think made it quite a kind of like embodied community thing, even though it had a lot of disconnect from the kind of like original PC music community.
And I miss it so much. Like, it was always in this club in Sydney that's since closed, but it's just this real kind of like basement, moldy, dank kind of vibe in there with really cheap alcohol that was, I don't know if it was legal how they were sourcing it, but just the energy of the place, the bass in your chest, the like people that were there was a very inclusive energy and like I would say predominantly queer as well. Mm. I think that's another part of it is like meeting the people in real life adds this extra element of like community.
Yeah, I'm wondering what the links are between queer community and this genre. Do you feel like that's a very strong bond there?
Definitely. I think, I mean, a huge proportion of the artists within the genre are LGBTQIA+. I think because queer people have always been at the forefront of innovation, because they've had to be, like they've had to create their own spaces a lot of the time. And I think hyperpop is the newest example of it.
A lot of the figureheads of the scene are queer or trans. Laura Les is trans from 100 Gecs. Like Sophie was trans. And like I was saying before, Sophie's ideology around production was very much an ideology that Sophie kind of like applied to gender and the world, like this idea of kind of limitless thinking. And I think that's very inspiring for a lot of queer and trans people. And I think probably the kind of experimentalism, the kind of like limitlessness of hyperpop speaks to this history of kind of radical transgression that's always been very embodied in the queer community. And I think that maybe has been a little defanged, you know, with this corporate pride spectacle that so often happens. Mm. So something like hyperpop, which although it's been picked up by Spotify and like obviously this creates a lot more debate, but like the fact that it is so aggressively active, you know, as compared to, you know, a lot of really corporate kind of streamable music now is very soft and very easy to hear. I think it has some of that radical transgressive element.
You say that it's inherently transgressive and radical, but as you mentioned, Spotify had this big hand in solidifying the genre. And I'm wondering how artists feel about that. Someone at a global company essentially naming a playlist or pressing a button and deciding this is what your sound is. It's hyperpop and go make some more.
Like as with everything in hyperpop, it's pretty controversial and contested. Like I think a lot of younger artists in the genre especially just see the app as kind of a really important platform, and fair enough, because it's, you know, helped them have an income and that kind of thing. And then I think maybe a few of the kind of like older or more kind of like politically engaged participants in the scene are very much like a corporation can't really foster a community, and it is definitionally kind of anti-community, some might say, for a corporation to have so much sway in how a sound exists, who gets to be platformed, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, Spotify definitely has influenced a lot of people to create within the sound and genre that is, yeah, hyperpop. And I'm not necessarily sure whether it's a good thing, because I think now that it's becoming a more commercialized, established kind of a genre, it's kind of almost forcing people to try and get on that playlist by making music that suits it.
Kind of has lessened the DIY aspect, possibly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I guess it does kind of suck a little bit of the creativity out of it in a way, because you sometimes are considering making music to fit the genre or to fit the playlist as opposed to the other way round, where we were making music that was just for ourselves.
It's kind of an inversion of what we saw happening with grunge in the 90s. You know, in the 90s, grunge was this response to kind of like consumer culture, and it was, you know, an outgrowth of like punk and indie rock and that kind of thing. And it was very non-commercial. And then suddenly major labels realized they could profit from it. And so they started signing every single grunge band, or like trying to manufacture grunge.
Mm.
And now you have an inverse of that situation, where a giant corporation, rather than waiting for the genre to come along and then capitalizing on it, is preempting the genre, creating it, and then essentially owning it.
Yeah, wow.
And so it's a pretty interesting reversal of how these things have ordinarily worked.
What do you think as a critic and a writer in this space? Do you think that Spotify's involvement has had a net benefit or negative impact on the artists and the genre?
I'm of the opinion that Spotify kind of already has kind of a vice-like grip on the industry that is kind of homogenizing music in this quite intense, quite upsetting way. And what's pretty interesting is that PC Music started kind of as a critique of like corporate and kind of like capitalist culture. And now we're in this place where not only is the sound that kind of all those people sparked really reliant on a streaming platform, but also, you know, you have a lot of major labels trying to kind of swoop in and sign a lot of artists before they get a chance to even kind of exist in this DIY space. I mean, that's kind of getting tangential, but, you know, it's in a pretty interesting spot from where everything started like 8 years ago.
Okay, that was so fascinating. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me.
Thanks to Shad D'Souza for their time. You can check out their piece on Hyperpop at theguardian.com. We've also put a link on the full story page to that as well. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Joe Koning, Miles Herbert, and Ryan Pemberton. The senior producer of Full Story is myself, Laura Murphy-Oates, and the executive producers are Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. If you liked this episode, don't forget to subscribe, or you can leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.